Their trademark logo is a fierce and determined bee clutching a hammer, a wrench, and a submachine gun. The official motto of these warfighters is Conscriptus Bitimus, Latin for we build, we fight, but better known as their slogan, can do. And if they hadn't constructed the bunkers at Con Tien and Quezon, where my rifle platoon took shelter from North Vietnamese rocket and artillery fire, I might not be here today. I'm Oliver North, and this War Stories podcast, you're going to meet some of the best and bravest men with whom I've ever served, the U.S. Navy's Seabees. They take their nickname from the first two letters of their official title, Construction Battalions. And since 1942, they've accompanied Marines and Naval forces around the globe to some of the most difficult and dangerous places on Earth. No other branch of the U.S. Navy has served in more theaters of war or tackled more challenging missions than the Seabees. During World War II, Admiral Ernest J. King, Chief of Naval Operations, said, quote, "Seabee ingenuity and fortitude have become a legend in the naval service." Indeed it has. From the sweltering jungles of Guadalcanal to the arid deserts of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan, Seabees have upheld their proud tradition as fighters who build and builders who fight. In this riveting War Stories podcast, we pay tribute to the oft-overlooked men and women of the Navy's fighting Seabees. You'll meet Joseph Schawinski of the 133rd Naval Construction Battalion. He landed beside the Marines on Iwo Jima and lived to tell the story. This is a podcast, so you can feel free to be inspired, maybe even tear up, listening to Johnny McCulley and Frank Peterlin of CB Team 1104. They served in Vietnam with Marvin Shields, the only Seabee to be awarded a Congressional Medal of Honor. And if you still wonder why Seabees say, "We do the difficult immediately, the impossible takes a little longer," come with us from their training center in California to the shadows of the Hindu Kush. The Seabees have war stories aplenty that deserve to be told. Hold your position.
They call themselves Seabees. They're the warrior builders of the U.S. Navy's construction battalions. I'm Oliver North, and this is War Stories, coming to you from the U.S. Navy's Seabee Museum, Port Hueneme, California. Seabees landed beside the Marines on Iwo Jima, helped Patton cross the Rhine, and built the bunker I lived in at Quezon. Their motto, "We build, we fight," has taken them with a rifle in one hand and a hammer in the other to every major battlefield in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and beyond. Today, their can-do spirit and legendary ingenuity is evident in Iraq, Afghanistan, and anywhere else that the global war on terror is being fought. Join us tonight as we pay tribute to the men and women of the U.S. Navy Seabees.
December 1941. Before the Seabees were created, some 70,000 civilian contractors employed by the U.S. Navy's Bureau of Yards and Docks were working on construction projects overseas. Most were spread out over the Pacific, building bases on tiny specks of coral like Wake Island, Midway, and Guam.
These civilian contractors were the same kind of construction workers who had worked on a lot of the big projects like Hoover Dam, Triborough Bridge in the 1930s.
Tell me about what the Bureau of Yards and Docks does.
The Bureau of Yards and Docks was first started in 1842 to build naval shore establishments.
Lara Goodby is the director of the U.S. Navy Seabee Museum in Port Hueneme, California, home to the Pacific Seabees.
Naval shore establishments are where the Navy basically refuels. It refuels its planes, it refuels its ships, it refuels its personnel.
As war engulfed Europe and Asia, there was great concern that it soon would arrive on our doorstep. 49-year-old Rear Admiral Ben Morrell feared we'd be unprepared and urged the Navy to create construction units of skilled builders trained to fight. The St. Louis native had befriended President Franklin Roosevelt during World War I and was hand-picked as chief of the Bureau of Yards and Docks.
Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam, and this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway.
After Pearl Harbor, obviously, they couldn't have civilian contractors in the middle of a war zone, and that is why the Seabees were born.
Barely a month after Pearl Harbor, the first unofficial Seabees, calling themselves Bobcats, left the United States for French Polynesia. As the Bobcats labored in the Pacific, Admiral Morrell's wish was finally granted. On 5 March 1942, the Seabees became official.
I'm Admiral Ben Morrell. I had the honor to be the organizer of this brand new branch of the Navy, the first King Bee.
Some 325,000 would serve during World War II.
They sent out recruiters and posters and said, this is what we need, and we need it now. And they were flooded with people who wanted to join and wanted to build and fight.
Gina Nichols archives 12,000 cubic feet of photos, film, and documents at the Seabee Museum.
The average age of a Seabee was 35 years old during World War II, but they had found several of them that were well over 60.
Each Naval Construction Battalion, or NCB, had 1,000 men commanded by 33 officers of the CEC, the Civil Engineer Corps. The King Bee himself furnished them with their official motto, "We build, we fight."
The reason they were called Seabees is because they were construction battalions, and therefore letter C, letter B. So to kind of boost morale, they came up with this idea of having a logo.
The logo was the brainchild of a 22-year-old talented cartoonist, Frank Iafredi. His first design was of a hard-working beaver, but a trip to his local library confirmed that in times of trouble, the beaver turns tail and runs. Iafredi then thought of the busy bee. It sported a white sailor's hat, a hammer, a wrench, and of course, a Tommy gun for when he fights. The first Seabees completed recruit training at Camps Perry and Allen in Virginia. Three more facilities were soon established: Davisville, Rhode Island, Gulfport, Mississippi, and Port Hueneme, California.
The Seabees' basic mission throughout World War II was to build advanced bases.
And anything west of Pearl Harbor was an advanced base.
Exactly. And pretty much anything east of Florida was an advanced base. They were building barracks, hospitals, all that kind of thing for any branch of the service who needed it.
They would build more than 400 advanced bases as they traveled the five roads to victory.
They're imaginary roads. It kind of shows the path that the U.S. military took during World War II to fight their enemy. Those that left from the east either went the North Atlantic route, and some went the Southern Atlantic route. Then from Port Hueneme, they went either the South Pacific, Central Pacific, or the Northern Pacific.
The Seabees were less than 6 months old when their first unit came under fire. Only 3 weeks after the Marines hit the beach at Guadalcanal, Seabees of the 6th Naval Construction Battalion came ashore.
Carpenter's mate First Class Larry Klatt and the 18th NCB joined the 6th on Guadalcanal in December of 42.
Our assignment was to build that fighter strip at Henderson Field, which our commander was going to see completed in the deadline time if it hair-lipped him. He had everybody, including cooks and bakers, out there carrying steel.
The 22-year-old son of a Colorado fruit farmer was an architect's apprentice before joining the Navy.
What was your personal job?
Was carrying Marston mat to lay on the airstrip.
Each strip of that Marston matting, that's heavy stuff.
Well, each man was carrying about 50, 60 pounds. We used boat hooks to carry it because the sheets are metal or perforated, you know. So two guys, one on each end, would carry a sheet and lay it in place.
And you're getting bombed on a regular basis.
We were getting air raids every night.
In typical Seabee fashion, the airstrip was finished ahead of schedule, but Larry's job was far from over. Next stop, Bloody Tarawa.
The Japanese simply held their fire, then they opened up. And they had us just dead in the water.
And their fortifications were the key to that kind of a defense.
Mm-hmm.
No one anticipated how effective their construction would be. And it turns out you're given the assignment of actually showing the brass how well they built their fortifications.
It was imperative that Admiral Nimitz know exactly what we were up against, what these things were made of, and how they were made and put together, exactly what they could expect from here on out if we ever took another fortified island.
Larry, the top drawing shows a beach emplacement, something the Marines had not seen before, Tarawa.
Right. They
came pretty close to the edge, and you can see they built double layers of coconut filled with sand in between them with the steel plate over the top.
Were you aware that the Navy then built a gunnery range in Hawaii based on your drawings? So that before a U.S. Navy vessel left Pearl Harbor, they had to fire and qualify on the range that your drawings were used to help build.
I was unaware. I never knew that till this moment.
You're credited with saving the lives of a lot of Marines.
What do you know about that?
Well, it's very impressive. How did a Seabee from St. Louis, Missouri end up in a top secret meeting with Winston Churchill? Find out next on War Stories. By March of 44, the tenacious Seabees were firmly established as a vital part of our Navy and caught the attention of Hollywood legend John Wayne, who starred in the hit movie The Fighting Seabees. The Duke paid homage to the warrior builders one last time in 1977 in his final production, Home for the Seabees.
I'll tell you, whenever I reached a forward area, I always looked up the Seabees because they were the best groundsers. They had the best chow, the best quarters, the best.
Can-do ingenuity is the hallmark of the Seabees, typified by things like Marston matting and the steel pontoon, sometimes called the magic box.
It could build causeways. It could build ferries. It could build anything.
First used by General George Patton in the Allied invasion of Sicily, it weighed a ton and floated in just 18 inches of water, carrying up to 20 times its weight. It would serve faithfully once again, 1,000 miles away in France. Eisenhower has decided we're going to go into Normandy. There's no real port facilities there. Who comes up with the idea for the floating piers?
The British came up with the idea of the Mulberries.
Operation Mulberry was the code name for the construction of two artificial harbors, essential for landing the troops and supplies to break through Hitler's defenses. Rumor has it that Prime Minister Winston Churchill devised the Mulberry Plan while playing with miniature models in his ship's bathtub while en route to the August 43 Quebec Conference. 20-year-old shipfitter Second Class Ray Dierkes from St. Louis found himself in this closed-door meeting in London when suddenly...
In come Mr. Winston Churchill, and he had his hat on and his cigar and said, "Gentlemen, we want you to know that we thought the Seabees would be the best people to build and erect this portable harbor."
The plan called for two harbors, Mulberry A for the American landing beaches and Mulberry B for the British. The prefabricated parts were built in England, towed across the English Channel, and assembled a mile off the Normandy coast.
By bringing our own harbor, we chose where we wanted to come in. If we did not bring the equipment in, the invasion would have failed.
Joining Ray Dierkes in the 108th NCB was 19-year-old Cleveland native Bobby Pintar. Each Mulberry had three main components. First, the pier heads maneuvered by Ray Dierkes' Charlie Company.
A pier head had a 200 by 60 foot wide steel pontoon deck. And each corner was a 4 by 4 steel 60 foot long spud operated by electrical engines and cables. We could run the spuds down into the seafloor, and then the deck would go up and down with the water.
Bobby Pintar's Alpha Company towed in the Phoenixes, hollow concrete boxes sunk to provide a breakwater for the pierheads.
It had a nickname called Coffin. If you were on the catwalk, which is 160 foot between the bow and the stern, and you fall in, you're falling down 60 foot into the solid concrete.
And Delta Company positioned the Whales, 80-foot bridge spans leading from the pierheads to the shore. The pierheads, phoenixes, and bridge spans all fit together like a giant jigsaw puzzle, forming two artificial harbors weighing 1 million tons each. But before the Mulberries could be assembled and the Rhino ferries could offload their cargo, Seabees and Army engineers had to destroy Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's deadly Atlantic Wall.
There were Seabees who were attached to these underwater demolition teams that went ashore and did a lot of the demo work. Normally, that's what the Army Corps of Engineers did.
This is the greatest amphibious operation in military history.
I had a front row seat. for all his showing.
Meanwhile, 19-year-old Bobby Pintar was riding across the channel on the Coffin. He was on watch when 10 miles off the coast, he heard two splashes.
I hollered down, there are mayday, mayday, torpedoes, torpedoes. Everybody on deck.
The first two missed, but four more German E-boat torpedoes were headed in Bobby's direction.
When a torpedo hit us with a thud, it was silent for a moment or two, and then a very, very large kaboom. It blew us up. We were then pulled down with the sinking of the Phoenix to the bottom of the English Channel, and during that time, you're in a process of drowning, and your brain is passing you by with your whole life.
Of the 12 men, only six survived. As seen here in this picture, they were picked up 6 hours later by the British ship HMS Vivacious. Bobby Pintar's Phoenix never made it, but Ray Dierkes and Charlie Company successfully hooked up to the bridge spans and got the job done. Mulberry A was open for business just 8 days after the invasion.
When LST finally unloaded their first thing, we all clapped because we were so proud that they could go on dry all the way to shore.
5 days later, the worst storm in 40 years destroyed the man-made American harbor. But some 9,000 tons of equipment and 11,000 troops had made it ashore.
When my dad's division was landed at Normandy, they walked across one of those causeways that the Seabees had actually built down there. There's a story that George Patton managed to cross the Rhine with the help of Seabees.
And it is a true story. However, he would not allow them to wear Seabee uniforms. So they were actually wearing Army uniforms. But in many cases, if you look hard enough on the photos, you actually see the little Seabee on their shirts.
A Seabee who stormed the beaches of Iwo Jima side by side with the Marines. His little-known story when War Stories returns.
By early 45, the long-range strategic bombing of Japan was in full swing. Army engineers and 15 Seabee battalions, including Larry Klatt and the 18th, had turned the island of Tinian into the world's largest airport.
We would see B-29s taken off one after the other.
19,000 combat missions were launched, including the two that ultimately ended the war. But Tinian was still 1,500 miles away from Tokyo. We needed to be closer to Japan.
Why is the island of Iwo Jima so important?
Because we were losing too many airmen coming back after bombing raids in Japan.
23-year-old Joe Shewinsky of the 133rd NCB was the son of a choir director from Stamford, Connecticut. His battalion was attached to the 4th Marine Division for the invasion of Iwo Jima.
You couldn't tell me from a Marine. I had the Marine fatigues. I had the emblem.
The actual plan that you guys were briefed on would have had the assault waves go ashore first, and immediately thereafter, you guys would land behind the Marines. It turns out, by mistake, you're landed in the assault waves.
All I know is that when our battalion hit the beach, there were Marines in front of us and the Marines in back of us.
It's not clear why the events unfolded as they did, but the records speak for themselves. Joe Shewinsky's entire battalion had landed by late afternoon on D-Day, 19 February 1945.
Colonel, when did you discover that there was a Seabee unit in the assault wing?
A C Company of the 133rd Seabee Battalion was assigned to my ship, and they landed with us. I can absolutely certify that.
Shelton Scales commanded the 3rd Battalion, 23rd Marines in the 4th Marine Division.
See them going down that net with that bobbing landing craft, boy, I felt sorry for them.
When you got ashore, did you see any of the Seabees?
Yeah, working on the airfields or putting in telephone lines.
We went right in and started working.
Joining Joe Shewinsky and Shelton Scales on Iwo Jima was Seabee Detachment 1078, and New Yorker Buddy White.
We used to convert salt water to fresh water. And then we also put up huge Quonset huts and inventoried thousands and thousands of pots.
You guys have got to clear the beach, build roads under fire.
Oh, yes.
All the way out to where these airfields are going to be.
You don't even know. When you're handling heavy equipment, you don't know that round is coming.
Can't hear.
Can't hear. You got Seabees, you have Marines, struggling for their lives, trying to do their job under extreme circumstances.
Colonel, did you know that the Seabees were taking horrific casualties?
There were more casualties in the rear area of Iwo than there were along the front lines.
By the end of the 26-day battle for Iwo Jima, the 133rd had suffered 40% casualties, 42 dead, 328 wounded, the highest of any CB unit in the war. For their action at Iwo Jima, CBs of the 133rd were awarded the Navy Unit Commendation. But Shelton Scales in the 4th Marine Division received a more prestigious award, the Presidential Unit Citation, or PUC.
Is that fair?
We were doing the same thing on the same beach, even wearing the same uniform. But the PUC doesn't come to us. I don't know how you can separate between a CB getting the PUC and the 4th Marine Division getting the PUC.
Somebody made a big mistake when they left them off, and I feel very, very strongly about them getting this before all of them are gone. At least let's honor those who are left.
Korea, 1950, with typical can-do spirit, a group of Seabees sneak behind enemy lines in a daring escapade. The Great Seabee Train Robbery, next on War Stories.
The end of World War II brought a rapid demobilization of our armed forces, including the Seabees. By 1946, there were a mere 3,000, down from 325,000 at the height of the war.
What happens to these guys?
Well, Seabees were originally a temporary organization, but then very quickly, they realized, you know what, these guys did a really good job for us, and maybe we should keep them around. And so in 1947, they became a permanent part of the Navy.
25 June 1950, over 100,000 communist North Korean troops storm across the 38th parallel, invading the Democratic South. The world was at war once again, and so were the Seabees.
On September 15, 1950, Seabees of Amphibious Construction Battalion No. 1 brought the 1st Marine Division ashore at Incheon.
Battling treacherous 30-foot tides and enemy fire, the Seabees built a pontoon causeway and helped land 70,000 of General MacArthur's Marines and soldiers. But shortly after muscling through one of the most brilliant amphibious assaults in military history, a curious incident occurred.
The Great Seabee Train Robbery is a piece of Seabee lore. As they were landing everything in Incheon, all the equipment was backing up because there was just nowhere to take it.
And so the Seabees actually crossed enemy lines and went to a beer factory. They found a plethora of leftover trains. They ended up taking the trains and a few packs of beer and crossing back over to the harbor so that they could bring all the supplies.
One of the most incredible Seabee feats of the Korean War took place in the tiny island of Yeouido in Wonsan Bay, a key supply center for communist North Korea. Corsairs from Navy Task Force 77 pounded the enemy stronghold almost daily.
We were launching combat flights from the aircraft carriers offshore, and frequently planes would be damaged and not able to make it back to the ships. Some would ditch in the ocean.
26-year-old Lieutenant Junior Grade William Sturman grew up on a ranch in New Mexico. He'd joined Amphibious Construction Battalion 1 2 years earlier.
And somebody came up with the idea, let's build a little landing strip on Yeouido. It's just long enough to be a little bigger than an aircraft carrier. And the exec of ACB-1, he says, we can do it, we can build it. Sturman, make it happen. So I loaded up an LST with CBs and pontoons on the side and construction equipment, and we moved up to Wonsan.
Describe this runway. that gets built on this tiny little island.
We offloaded all the equipment and the Seabees, and the job started laying a Marston matting, pure steel planking, runway from shore to shore, all the way across the little rice paddy island.
The Seabees were under fire a lot in Korea.
That's correct. Particularly in that Wonsan Harbor, that Yeouido Island construction. They could easily throw around right down the runway as the guys were building it, but they couldn't do a lot of damage. So the guys would just hold off and run out and fill the hole when the shells landed. And just about the time it was finished, we saved, I think it was 7 Navy fighter planes that came in on their way back that were out of fuel and landed and saved all of them.
As war raged in Korea, 5 CB battalions were 1,600 miles away in the Philippines.
Their project, a major air and sea facility at Kubi Point on Subic Bay. The CBs spent 5 years carving jungle and mountains into a first-class modern base for the fleet.
They could not find a civilian contractor at that time that would even bid on the job out there.
Never one to shy away from a tough job, 21-year-old Oklahoma farm boy Johnny McCulley signed up for the monumental challenge.
There was basically 3 mountains sticking out like this, and the bay was in between here.
And they basically lopped off the entire top of a mountain. They used that material to backfill some swampland, and they built one of the largest bases in the world.
There was more earth moved in constructing that base than what was moved in construction of the Panama Canal.
Another role of the Seabees in the 1950s era was being involved in Operation Deep Freeze. The U.S. started looking at Antarctica and seeing if it was possible to do any kind of construction there. This was obviously part of the entire Cold War movement and trying to spread as far as possible. And like always, the Seabees said, of course we can do.
That runway was actually built by Seabees.
They would have to go through with specialized dozers and create entire, 6,000-foot-long runways on ice.
Outnumbered 100-1, 9 Seabees endure a harrowing assault in the jungles of Vietnam.
The story of Seabee Team 1104. That's next on War Stories.
During the post-Korean, pre-Vietnam period, the need for a new kind of CB developed, a people-to-people CB. This new breed of B serves as a member of a CB team, 13 dedicated men helping people to help themselves.
Throughout the 1960s, there was an entire push from the top down to use the U.S. military as an agent of civic action. In terms of Cold War, it's a way of helping people who might be more apt to go toward the communist side instead go for Americans.
Make sure it's clean before you put any grease on it.
You basically just went out and built rooms in the countryside and helped the natives out.
Master Chief Equipmentman Johnny McCulley had been a CB for 18 years when he deployed to Vietnam in 1965 as part of Team 1104.
We had Lieutenant J.J. Peterlin, Frank Peterlin, as officer in charge. I, Johnny McCulley, was assistant officer in charge.
Equipment operator, mechanic, and builder. You got 2 of each of those. And then engineering aide, your electrician, your steel worker, and your corpsman.
27-year-old CEC officer Frank Peterlin from Oglesby, Illinois, was in charge of Team 1104. They were tasked with building a camp for the Army Special Forces in Dong Xoai, 65 miles north of the South Vietnamese capital, Saigon.
What other Americans are out there on the ground with you?
Special Forces A-Team is all that is there.
It's mutual respect among the two groups.
30-year-old Army Captain William Stokes from Lynchburg, Virginia, led the 11-man Special Forces A-Team. With the 20 Americans at the camp were some 250 local militiamen.
Having the Seabees there was a bonus for us because it gave us more Americans to help supervise defense.
We are there because a friendly nation has asked us for help against the communist aggression. 10 years ago, our president pledged our help. 3 presidents have supported that pledge, and we will not break it now.
By the time CB Team 1104 arrived in Dong Xoai on 4 June 65,
there were some 20,000 American boots on the ground in Vietnam. Among them, 26-year-old construction mechanic third class Marvin Shields.
Marv was a lumberjack kind of from the Northwest. Very gentle guy. He was the type of person that spent his spare time using his saw to make chopping blocks for all the Vietnamese women that were around there who needed that type of thing.
The Seabees hit the ground running, hauling gravel and building the camp's defensive perimeter. Just 5 days after they arrived, all hell broke loose.
The attack started 15 minutes before midnight on the night of 9th of June.
They were just bombarding the camp with mortar rounds and recoilless rifles. And they knocked out the communication right away.
Outnumbered 100-1, the 20 Americans, including the 9 Seabees, were surrounded by an estimated 2,000 determined Viet Cong.
Rounds were coming in continually for the next couple hours.
Then it quieted down about 10 or 15 minutes, and then it started again. That's when we were really hurting, because we didn't have the ammo. We didn't have, I couldn't even find rocks to throw back. I'd taken a machine gun round through the right shoulder.
I had a shattered right leg, something through my left arm, and a broken left ankle. I couldn't walk.
Marvin Shields was over on that northwest berm. That was basically his firing position. Had some wounds upside his head or face here.
Marv was running around making sure everybody had ammo.
It was about to get worse. At 02:30, 3 hours after the first shots were fired, rolling waves of enemy troops armed with automatic weapons and flamethrowers reached the perimeter and overran the camp.
And I just got knocked on my face with an explosion. The real damage was a wound in my foot, which cut the nerve. And every time I tried to get up, I'd fall on my face again.
Marvin Shields put me on his back in a fireman's carry, and together with Sergeant James Taylor carried me to the district compound. I certainly owe my life to Marvin Shields and Jim Taylor, who carried me to safety.
Peterlin and McCulley were now behind enemy lines, surrounded and cut off from the rest of the Americans. Meanwhile, a few hundred yards away, Stokes and Shields were pinned down by machine gun fire coming from this nearby school. One of Stokes' men decided to take it out.
Lieutenant Williams picked up the 3.5 rocket launcher that we had available, asked for someone to load for him.
Of course, Shields, even though he was seriously wounded, volunteered right away. He had the ammo before he finished asking for it. And they shot out the machine gun.
They started pulling back, and another machine gun that they had not observed before opened up. Shields was hitting a leg. It basically tore his leg off.
With four dead and Marvin Shields hanging on for dear life, the welcome sound of helicopter blades grew close.
Shields was still alive, but barely. That's when he told him, "Move me gently, boys. I'm fragile."
Unfortunately, you know, Marv died on the helicopter, not a few minutes, I think, after it took off.
Seabees Peterlin and McCulley were left for dead as the choppers lifted off with Shields and 13 others. Separated with no communications, little did they know they were the only two Americans left on the ground.
They ordered the planes to hit the entire campsite.
They're dropping bombs or strafing or both?
Bombs and strafing, big time. And that bombing and strafing continued the next whole day and the next whole night. And I was in this fighting hole with the VC all around me. The only time when I even dared to leave that area was the following morning when some helicopters flew over and there was no return fire.
And just came out of the woods, a chopper was picking off the ground, and he saw me coming out and he set me down. When I pulled myself up on the chopper, there laid Frank in the second row of the stretchers. I was happy to see.
All told, CB Team 1104 suffered 7 wounded, 2 dead. 100% casualties. Frank Peterlin and Johnny McCulley both received the Silver Star, and Marvin Shields was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, the first and only CB to receive one.
The brutal murder of a CB diver changes the way we fly. That's next on War Stories.
One hour ago, the body of a young American hero, Navy diver Robert Dean Stathen, was returned to his native soil in a coffin.
14 June 1985, Athens, Greece. The world watched in horror as Islamic militants hijacked TWA Flight 847.
Had two cans of maize in his flight. All the passengers was maize and came flying in the aircraft.
23-year-old CB diver Robert Stethem stood up to defend a fellow passenger. The terrorist tortured him and then shot him at point-blank range and tossed his body from the aircraft.
He was really the CB's first casualty on the global war of terrorism.
I have directed the Secretary of Transportation, in cooperation with the Secretary of State, to explore immediately an expansion of our armed Sky Marshal program for better protection of passengers.
2 months after this order, Congress created the current FAA-controlled Federal Air Marshal Program,
please don't move,
which added armed marshals to international flights operated by U.S. carriers. 16 years later, it was toughened again following the terrorist attack of September 11, 2001.
All Saddam Hussein has to do is get out of Kuwait, and this war is over.
After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, CBs were called upon to build some 200 miles of highway for General Norman Schwarzkopf's counteroffensive.
When did women first start coming into the CBs?
Women have been serving the CBs since 1972. However, they didn't begin serving in combat roles until 1994. And actually, recently, the CBs have lost their first woman as it killed in action, a petty officer, Regina Clark, in Iraq.
I have about 16,000 CBs. 40% are active force, and 60% are the reserve force.
And how many of your CBs, Admiral, are deployed overseas?
About 2,200.
52-year-old Rear Admiral Bob Phillips from Charleston, South Carolina, is now at the helm of all current CB battalions.
A hefty number of my troops are supporting the special operation forces, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. You've been over there, and it's 120 degrees. They're in full combat gear. They're taking indirect fire on a day-in, day-out basis with a smile on their face, nose to the grindstone, making it happen.
What's done today to recruit a youngster who has those kinds of skills the CBs need?
When the CBs were started, they brought folks in that built the Boulder Dam, built the National Transportation System or the skyscrapers in New York. It's different today. Today we train our troops.
This is where thousands of today's CBs hone their skills. Fort Hunter Liggett, California, a 250-square-mile Army facility 3 hours south of San Francisco.
What we have here is a training map that we have labeled as provinces, because that's pretty much what we're focusing on over in Iraq.
A 12-year veteran of the CBs and current war on terror, 33-year-old Chief Builder Clovis Tennis gave War Stories a tour. He's with the 31st CB Readiness Group in charge of all the training.
What's your mission here?
To construct a Bailey Bridge over a creek.
Okay. Is there a defensive perimeter here? We've got a crew serve weapon, a 50 cal up there, M2. They're covering the avenue of approach into their camp, ensuring that nobody comes through it's not supposed to. They can probably construct this bridge in about 8 hours.
Great. One, two, three.
Getting the Marine Corps rolling forward and the logistical supplies to support the Marine Corps as they advance. Well, right now we're in MOP level one, which is Mission Oriented Protective Posture 1. As we get more intel about threats, then we would go up and we'd add the boots, we'd add the mask, and we'd add the gloves.
Mask, mask, Mach 4! Yes,
yes! In all of our training, we try to achieve the troops going from MOP 0, which is without their chemical suit on, to MOP 4 in less than 2 minutes. 10:30, 11 o'clock this morning when we come out. Now it's
right now.
It's about 15:30. It's almost complete.
It's because you got it tilted too much.
It's a damn good time for that bridge. I got something to go home and be proud of. So they did good.
CB can do!
War Stories brought Vietnam veteran Johnny McCulley to watch the new generation of CBs at work.
You guys know who Marvin Shields is, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. He was the chief in charge of Marvin Shields during the battle where Marvin Shields lost his life.
Oh, no kidding.
But they're right seasoned.
They're right seasoned.
MTVRs, you put a full load on them, you can still cruise at 55, 60 with no problem whatsoever.
How many people put in there? About two squads?
We usually haul about 24 bodies.
I think it's great. They do a good job.
The OP up on top of the hill behind us has notified the react team that he sees something suspicious out there.
During this exercise, some CBs keep out the insurgents, while others continue to build under fire.
They wanted to attack the unit with the objective of dismantling or damaging the bridge that the CBs were doing down here.
Hey, we need more rounds down here!
We also went to survival training. That type of training saved us. And anyone on my team, I think, would tell you the same thing, because it showed you that your human endurance was much greater than you yourself actually believed it was.
More on the Navy's construction battalions. That's next on War Stories. Admiral Ernest J. King, the chief of naval operations in World War II, said that CB ingenuity and fortitude had become legendary. Indeed, he's right. From the jungles of Guadalcanal to the deserts of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan, they've upheld their proud tradition as fighters who build and builders who fight. With their famous can-do spirit, no other branch of our Navy has served in more theaters of war or tackled more challenging missions than the Navy Seabees. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.